I want to begin this morning with a question. And the question is this: what does it take to please God? What does it take? Money? Like, you know, help God out. He's in a tight spot. Give him a little hardship loan. What does it take to please God? Our muscle. We flex and he's like, ooh, wow. Never seen the likes of that before. Our religious traditions and things we do, lending him a hand. Is it even possible to please God? And if it is, how do we do it? I want us to think about that question and come back to it in a little bit here. We are continuing our journey through the life of Jesus. We've been taking a journey for the last, since this December, on the life of Jesus, before that through the Bible. And we've been, it's going to be a long journey. We're not in a hurry to get through Jesus. He's kind of the point. So we're moving along at a pace. And today is a story I want us to see that is found in two spots. It's found in Luke chapter 7 and Matthew chapter 8. If you want to turn there in your Bibles, you can do so. The verses will be on the screen. Let's jump right in. Luke chapter 7 verse 1 says, "When Jesus had finished saying all of this to the people, he returned to Capernaum." Now remember that Jesus has been working in Capernaum an awful lot. He sort of bases out of there. That's his that's home in a lot of ways, even though he was raised in Nazareth. And he's been there a lot. People have seen him. Many have believed on him there, but many also do not still. And that was some of the frustration we saw him express last Sunday on that message. But he's coming back today to Capernaum. It says in verse 2 that at that time, the highly valued slave of a Roman officer was sick and near death. Now remember, the Roman Empire rules over much of that part of the world at that time, and they are overseeing Israel. They take taxes from the nations they control. They occupy them with their forces. No one really likes that. No nation likes to have a foreign power ruling over you and present in all your towns and cities. And Israel certainly doesn't like it because they're God's people. They're supposed to be free from all of that, in their minds especially. But there's the Roman Empire. And here in Capernaum is a Roman officer who is stationed there. And that creates tension already. But he has no doubt seen the work of Jesus. Jesus has been working in Capernaum for almost all of his ministry so far, and the Roman officer would be aware of it. And apparently, as we're going to see, he's a believer, which is a hard category for some people in those days to embrace. But he has a highly valued slave, or as Matthew would say, a dearly loved servant, that is sick and near death. And many times people in that kind of power would just say, well, if I lose one, I'll just get another. Who cares? But he cares. This Roman officer cares for those that are in his care. And so he decides to do something about it. It says in verse number 3, when the officer heard about Jesus, or in other words, heard that Jesus was coming back into town, when he heard that, he sent some respected Jewish elders to ask him to come and heal his slave. Now, we tend to gloss right over that verse, and I don't want us to do that because that's pretty remarkable that a Roman officer would ask Jewish elders to go on his behalf and talk to Jesus. You understand, right, that Roman officers and the Jewish people weren't always cozy, especially the Jewish elders. The Jewish leadership in most towns and in the government were very political slash religious mix, the way that their nation had been structured from the beginning. And even though Rome ruled over them, these elders were not very cozy to Rome, and Rome didn't appreciate them back because there was mutinies. The history of that era throughout the books that are written are full of revolts and skirmishes and rebellions. And so while this Roman officer was not Caesar himself, he was working for Caesar and he was representing a foreign power in Israel, in Capernaum. How does that man get the Jewish elders to go on his behalf to talk to Jesus? It's pretty remarkable. Why would they be willing to do that? Well, here's why. It says in verse 4, so they, that's the Jewish elders, so they earnestly begged Jesus to help the man, to help the Roman officer. They said, if anyone deserves your help, he does. Now, hold on now. I'm not even sure these Jewish elders believed on Jesus themselves. I mean, they like his miracles. He's done miracles there. They probably wanted more of that. But I'm not so sure they were followers based upon other stories involved here. But they knew where to come if they needed help. And they come to Jesus on behalf of they're not coming on their own behalf. What would make them come and beg Jesus for anything? Let alone for somebody else, let alone for a Roman officer. It's really a remarkable story. And they say, he deserves it. He is worthy of it. Why would they say that? Look at verse number 5. They said, for he loves the Jewish people, and he even built a synagogue for us. Can we just speculate? What would it take for your enemies who rule over you to convince you that they love you? I mean, seriously, we have a hard time giving credit to anybody who's opposes us, don't we? We struggle with saying, hey, I respect. You know, if someone's against us and against our views or opposing us in any way, religiously, politically, you know, church structure-wise, whatever it may be, and especially if they have a position of ruling over us, like they're in a position of leadership or power in our lives, we don't tend to like them very much if they're the opposition. And Rome was that. What would it take a Roman officer to convince Jewish people that he loves them? Well, you see, he built a synagogue for them, it says. That's part of it. I mean, he took the effort to say, you want a synagogue in every city, you want one in this city, and you don't have one, let me help fund and work to get you built a synagogue. That's pretty cool of him. But even then, that's not all, because it says he did that and he built that for them. In other words, he loves us in other ways. He didn't just convince the Jewish people that his presence, which was hostile by nature, was not so bad, or that he was a pretty good guy for a Roman officer. He has somehow convinced them that they said he loves us. I don't know who this guy is, but I'm impressed. I'm impressed with this Roman officer. Now the question is Jesus impressed? Well, let's keep reading the story. Let's flip over to Matthew's version real quick. We'll go back and forth. Over in Matthew chapter 8, verse 5, we're going to read the same story. It says, when Jesus returned to Capernaum, a Roman officer came and pleaded with him. He said, Lord, my young servant lies in bed, paralyzed and in terrible pain. Did you notice a discrepancy in the story? In Luke's version, he sends other people, Jewish elders, to talk to Jesus. But in Matthew, it says he came to Jesus himself. And that's the kind of stuff that can trip some people up. People who are critical of the story of Jesus and look to find fault. When you're looking to find fault with something, there's always ways to poke holes in it, right? We know that. You don't have to try very hard if you want to find fault. So I can't help someone who's determined to tear down the story. But for many of us who we are trying to lean in and embrace the story, we're like, wait a minute, that's a discrepancy. Did he come to Jesus according to Matthew, or did he send people to Jesus? That's different. And maybe you would have never noticed that before. Probably, if I hadn't pointed it out, most of us would have never noticed that before. Because we either don't read the Bible that much, or if we do, we're like reading Matthew at one time, and we read Luke at a whole different time, and we don't put those dots together. So I probably point out something to you that no one needed to see, right? But in case someone ever points that out, or in case you ever catch that, you're like, what is the deal? Is which one's right, which one's wrong, and why is there an error here? And a lot of how you handle that tension comes out of how you handle your view of the Bible and its writing. But remember, I've said this so many times, we have four different accounts of the life of Jesus from four different people, and they have different stories they tell. Each one tells different stories. They tell some of the same stories, but they have different orders. They weren't overly worried about chronological order most of the time. Sometimes they were, sometimes they weren't. They were just saying, here's what you need to know about who Jesus was. Oh, here's another story. Oh, here's another story. And it wasn't so chronological as it was, let's get it all on paper for you. And that's why you got to sometimes do the work we're doing for the series and sort and try to guess what to put next. And we know we're not getting it. We're not trying too hard because it's like, But then even in stories like this, sometimes the details are different. Because they're not always, but that to me, that does, depending on your view of scripture, that could shake you. But to me, it makes me feel good. Because if the stories were identical word for word in all accounts, I would start thinking, there's some collusion going on here. You know, they're too exact. But the fact that they're written by different people saying, here's the same big story, but here's some different things we recall, is one of the best evidences for the authority and the truth of the historical record. What's interesting is that this detail is not a discrepancy if you know how to look at it. Matthew, who's writing the story here, he's just saying, look, this guy came to Jesus. Matthew's not trying to go all Mr. Detail here. He's just like, the bottom line is the guy came to Jesus because he wanted a miracle. And Matthew and Luke both agree he came to Jesus because he needs a miracle, and Jesus gave it to him, as we're going to see in a few minutes. But Matthew's like, he came to Jesus, and that's all he says. But Luke, the historian, Luke's a historian, he gets all the witnesses, and he's like, actually, you know, he's going to be the actually guy. Actually, the way he came to Jesus was he sent people on his behalf, which is the same thing. If you're a position of power and an officer, and you want to get hold of Jesus, you come to Jesus through intermediaries. And Matthew just says, you don't need to know that. The bottom line is he came to Jesus. And Luke is like, well, yeah, he came to Jesus through sending others on his behalf. And why would he send Jewish elders? Why would they go? Maybe because he thought the Jewish rabbi would be more responsive to a Jewish request than a Roman request. But either way, he comes to Jesus, like Matthew says, through his intermediaries, like Luke tells us, and they ask Jesus to help him. And what does Jesus say? Jesus said, I will come and heal him. And that's good news. Now let's flip back to Luke for the rest of this, for the next part of the story. It says in verse 6, so Jesus went with them, that's with the entourage. He went with them, but just before they arrived at the house, the officer sent some friends to say, hey, Lord, don't trouble yourself by coming to my home, for I am not worthy of such an honor. Now that's kind of confusing. I thought he just literally sent people to come to Jesus to bring Jesus to his house to heal his servant. Now he's saying, don't come to my house. Do you no longer want the servant to be healed? Well, yes, he does. He has another solution in mind. But he sends his friends to get to Jesus before Jesus arrives. And his friends are like, hey, he is so thankful you agreed to come. He wasn't sure you would. But here's his message. You don't need to come to his home. He's not worthy. I'm not worthy of such an honor. Now, the Jewish elders told Jesus he was worthy of such an honor. But he's saying, I'm not worthy of such an honor. What is that? Is he just really humble? Well, probably. He was probably a humble guy. But there may be more to the story. Just studying it and looking it over, he did Jesus a favor. Remember, Jesus was criticized a lot by the Jewish religious leaders because he didn't fit into their Jewish religious system. Remember, he challenged their thinking. He had a whole new thing going on. And so many of the Jewish leaders at that time tried to tear down Jesus' ministry. And one of their favorite tactics was to ask him difficult questions that could trap him with either type of answer. One of their favorite tools to ask him was something about the Roman Empire that was ruling over them. Because if they could pit Jesus against Rome, they could turn Rome against Jesus. So they tried to pit Jesus against Rome and get him to say something that not that they liked Rome themselves, but if they could say, hey, to their enemy Rome, this guy's trouble for you, so get rid of our other enemy. That's convenient. But at the same time, if Jesus did not speak against Rome, but Jesus answered their questions and spoke for Rome, they could find fault with him that way also. Because then the Jewish people would be like, he is for Rome. That's a big no-no. He'd lose the crowd. So even going to a Roman officer's house could be a tricky thing for Jesus with his enemies, to go to the house of a Roman officer. So I don't know, some speculate the Roman officer for that reason did Jesus a very big favor and says, you don't need to come to my house. Or he was just humble. It doesn't matter. Both are true, right? Both are true. I'm not worthy for you to come to my house. Please don't trouble yourself. Then he says this, I am not even worthy to come out and meet you myself, which is, again, Matthew says he came to meet him, but he came through other people. I'm not worthy to come and meet you directly. He says, listen, just say the word, Jesus. Just say the word from where you are, and my servant will be healed. That's remarkable. He's saying, Jesus, you don't got to come to the house. You don't got to gather around the bed, hold hands with five people, throw some candles on, throw a playlist with some ambient music, have enough decibels to distance to the man's ears for the miracle to work. You don't need to do any of that. Right where you are, you can simply say the word and he'll be healed. That's impressive. Why does he think that? Well, he explains in verse 8. He says, I know this. I know this because I am under the authority of my superior officers, and I have authority over my soldiers. I only need to say go, and they go, or come, and they come. And if I say to my slaves, do this, they do it. Do you catch what he just said? What he just said is, I understand authority and I understand power. That he was saying, look, as a man with officers over me, they have the authority over me. When they tell me to do something, I do it. That's power that comes from authority. He says, I have people who answer to me. If I tell them I want something done, it gets done because of my authority. That's power. And he says to Jesus, Jesus, I believe you have authority and therefore power, but not just over people like I do. You have a power that none of us have, that I don't have, that no one else has. You have authority and power over sickness, and you have authority and power over disease and our bodies. And if you simply say the word, it gets done. In other words, he says, Jesus, I believe, I know who you are. It was a strong statement of incredible faith. How does Jesus respond? Let's look back again at Matthew chapter 8 and verse 10. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed. Those are words that you don't hear very many times in the scriptures, that Jesus was amazed. But when Jesus heard this, he was amazed. Everything that's happened before now in the story did not amaze him, but now his jaw is hanging open. And Jesus turning to those who were following him, the entourage perhaps, that were following him, Jesus said, I tell you the truth, I have not seen faith like this in all Israel. He's saying two things there. First of all, I've never seen faith like this before. This is the most impressive display of faith when he said, just speak the word, you have the authority and power to say it and it gets done. He said, that's an impressive faith. I've never seen the likes of that before. And then he said, I've never seen that kind of faith in all Israel. By pointing out Israel, he's saying the people who are supposed to be God's people haven't shown that kind of faith. We saw that last week a little bit too. Like Jesus is he says this kind of stuff and gets them in trouble with the religious leaders. It always does. He says, I've never seen faith like this at all. As a Roman officer. And now Jesus is going to opine. And I don't want you to miss this part because it's so beautiful. Jesus is going to like stop and do what a teacher sometimes does and get on a rabbit trail intentionally. So Jesus turns to the people that were with him in verse number 11. He says, and I tell you this, that many Gentiles will come from all over the world. Remember who Gentiles are? To the Jewish people that Jesus is talking to, Gentiles were everyone who was not Jewish. Like to the Jewish people, there's us, we're God's people, and then there's everybody else. There's us, and then everybody else. And we saw two Sundays ago that Jesus came to bring some new into the world. And what do we say? We said to embrace the new that Jesus came to do. Well, in that story was the new that Jesus came to do. A new covenant, new commands, new audience, new people that the covenant was for. And here he is making that point about the new he came to do. He said many Gentiles, many non-Jewish people from all over the world, from east and west, they will come and they will sit down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob at the feast in the kingdom of heaven. And he's referring to a feast in the kingdom of heaven, an event that will take place someday where people who at that time weren't around yet, because they will come from all over the world and sit down someday with people who at that time were dead for 2,000 years already, as far as we're concerned with death and life, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Jesus said, a feast will happen when people are going to sit down and eat in the kingdom of heaven with your patriarchs, and they are not going to be you. They're going to be Gentiles. That's some of the new that Jesus was bringing. By the way, Gentiles, aren't you glad? Aren't I glad? That's us. This is good news, okay? He says they're going to sit down and they're going to be a part of it all because this is what I'm bringing to the whole world. And then he adds this statement. This is what gets them in trouble with some of them. He says in verse 12, but many Israelites, or those for whom the kingdom was prepared, will be thrown into outer darkness, or they'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Many people who consider themselves in by birthright, in by privilege, but don't really care about the message of God or the person of Jesus. They don't believe in him. They won't follow him. They're like, you know what? I don't want a relationship with him because relationships are dynamic. What does God want from me? I just want to coast on my laurels and on my name and just, I don't care for that. And they think they're okay because of who they are. And Jesus said, they're going to miss out. While the people that they think are less than them from all over the world are going to sit down with their patriarchs and have a feast. That's the kind of talk that got Jesus into frustrating moments with the elders. But of course, he's opining right now. Not opining, he's speaking truth right now. But let's not forget what he's there for. We're like, hello, we got a guy, you know, a guy is sick and dying right now. Can we get back to the emergency at hand, please, Jesus? So Jesus in verse 13, then Jesus said to the Roman officer, he says, go back home because you believed it has happened. And the young servant was healed that same hour. So he or his intermediaries return home on his behalf. And look at what Luke chapter 7, verse 10 says this. And when the officer's friends returned to his house, they found the slave completely healed. And Jesus did the miracle from a distance by simply saying the word, just like the Roman officer knew he could. And that's the story for today. That's it. I'm going to say a few things about it before we're done, but I want you to know that's the story. And the reason I want to talk about that a little bit is because I want to ask a question that we didn't exactly ask at the beginning, but it's similar. In this story, what does it take to impress Jesus? Or what did it take to impress Jesus? That's a similar question that we started with, isn't it? The question we asked at the beginning was, what does it take to please God? And that's similar because Jesus was the Son of God who came into the world from the Father. The Word became human and dwelt among us, right? That's the incarnation. It's a miracle. It's beyond our comprehension, but we celebrate it all the time as followers of Jesus. And Jesus said, I and my Father are one. If you want to see the Father, you've seen him if you've seen me. So what impresses Jesus and God are the same, or what pleases them are the same. But not just pleasing him. Jesus was more than pleased in today's story. He was impressed, or as the word said, he was amazed. So what did it take to impress Jesus? And what's the answer? Faith. Exactly right. Faith. Can I just think with me? Jesus was not impressed by the fact that the Roman officer was a Roman officer. He's like, ooh, I got invited to a Roman officer's house. I'm somebody. I'm with the bigwigs now. That didn't impress Jesus. Jesus was not impressed by the fact that the Roman officer sent Jewish elders to talk to him or could. He wasn't impressed by the fact that he built a synagogue for the Jewish people. Jesus was not impressed by the fact that he loved the Jewish people. Those are all impressive things, but it didn't make Jesus amazed. What amazed him was simply that the man said, Lord, if you say the word, it gets done because that's the kind of authority and power you have because I know who you are. And his faith impressed Jesus, not all his other resume. And this is a big idea in the Bible. And I want to show you one other verse before we're done. Because after Jesus finishes his ministry and returns to glory, the early church would get really busy documenting the story of Jesus. In the next many years or two decades to follow, they'd write down the story of the life of Jesus that we're reading about today. They'd write the history of the early church. The apostles would write letters to the churches that were popping up all over the place to help them in their faith. And one of those letters in our, what we call the New Testament or the Christian writings, one of those letters is called the Book of Hebrews. And in Hebrews, which is written to the Hebrew or the Jewish people, there's a famous chapter called Hebrews chapter 11. How many of you are familiar with the content of Hebrews chapter 11? Okay, this chapter is a chapter, it tells the stories of people who had tremendous faith in the Hebrew history or in the Hebrew scriptures or the Old Testament. A lot of the stories that they read about in their scriptures were people who had great faith. And so Hebrews 11 lists all these people by name. This person had faith in this way. That person had faith in that way. And it gets to modern times where it names some unnamed people and says, people of faith look like this. We call Hebrews chapter 11 the Great Hall of Faith sometimes because of the whole, you should read it. It's a tremendous chapter. But in the great hall of faith, Hebrews chapter 11, faith is sort of laid out for us in plain terms. And the way it's laid out goes hand in hand with today's story. Let's look at it. Hebrews 11 verse 6 says this, "And it is impossible to please God without faith." It is impossible to please God without faith. Or can we turn that around? In other words, it is only possible to please God by our faith. It's only possible. What does it take to please God? Faith. And so we can say, well, what about all the other things? Well, what about the Roman officer's resume? He did some impressive stuff, but his faith pleased God. And yes, our faith might produce in us all the other stuff. Our faith might cause us to be generous, right? It should. Our faith might cause us to be hardworking, sacrificial, caring, have spiritual disciplines. But those are our fruits, the faith. You can do those things without faith. You can do those things for personal glorification reasons or trusting in yourself. But our faith in God is the foundation of all that pleases him. So you're saying, okay, Arlen, I hear you. You made the point. The verse is clear. The story was plain. God is pleased by our faith. But here's my question, Arlen. What does that look like? Is faith just a word you say and put on a, you crochet onto a pillow and put in your house or on your wall? What does faith look like? Well, the rest of this verse gives us some handles for what faith looks like. Let's read the whole verse. It says, "And it is impossible to please God without faith. Anyone who wants to come to him must believe that God exists and that he rewards those who sincerely seek him." And there it is. Two handles. We must believe that God exists, number one, and number two, that he rewards those who sincerely seek him. Let me just take a moment and break those down a little bit and we'll be done. First of all, that God exists. Do we believe that God exists? I think most of us would say, yes, I believe that. We might differ all over this room. We have people come to our church who you're not sure that you're buying in yet. You're like, I'm considering it. I show up, but I have questions that I don't know about. But it comes to faith. Wonderful. That's why we want our church to be a place where wherever we are on our faith journey is a safe environment to come and explore faith. But if you're here saying, I don't know if I believe the version of God that all the other people believe in, or the version of God that everyone else lays out of exactly how it's supposed to look, but I do believe that God exists. That's step one. Do we believe that God exists? That there is a higher power? That we are not here by accident? That somehow through insane logic, everything came from nothing by no means, and it accidentally formed a universe with a planet that can sustain human and animal life just perfectly positioned enough from its sun to carry on for the millennia and beyond life. And complex animal and human life that the more we study and understand our bodies and the more science advances, we still can't solve all of its problems and we still can't recreate it from scratch. It's just all amazing. And to say, I believe that there is intelligent design behind it all. There is a God. And we may differ on how somebody would argue you got to name him a certain way, but ultimately, I believe that God exists. That's handle number one. Handle two in this verse is that we believe that he exists and that he rewards those who sincerely seek him. That is a statement that says not only is there a God, but that God is love. That God in love created and gave us life, but that God also gave us freedom, choice. But he wants a relationship with us. And if you seek him, he rewards it. Now, he doesn't force it on us. He says, if you want to live your life without him, he will wish it. He will do everything he can to reach you. But he will not force himself on you because that's not what love does. But in love, he gives us life. And in love, he watches and says, man, I want us to do it together. And if anyone responds to him, everyone seeks him, he says, I'm in. I want that. I love you because he's a loving God. The bottom line is the handles in this verse are that ultimately that there is a God and God is love. And that's a big deal because most of us can find common ground there. No matter where we are in our journey, We can mostly find common ground there. We may bicker about what that looks like, but I don't know. Don't you get tired of all the churches that bicker about which expression denominationally is right about God, and actually this is wrong, and get mad on social media about people who don't say it the way they think they ought to say it. There's a lot. It's easy for people to be miserable in their defense of God. But in the bottom line category of it all, we can find common ground so much together under a simple idea that no matter where we are, can we just embrace that there is a God and that God is love? And if we can embrace that basic idea, we can build upon that foundation with Christianity. Because the Christian message is that God so loved the world that he gave his son. That God demonstrates his love for us through Christ, who died for us, that on the cross God showed forgiveness for our sins, and he rose again to kill our enemy of death and to bring us back into a restored relationship with him forever at his own expense. That God is love and that God exists is the foundation that no matter where you and I are today in that process, we can build upon that. And the Christian story builds on that foundation. It is that foundation. That is the whole truth. That's why the gospel writers said about Jesus, after spending years with him up close and personal, here's our summary: God is love. And so, based upon that verse and the story we read today, I want to give you a simple prayer to take home. And it'll be on the screen in just a moment here. When I put it on the screen, I want you to say just a few words. Write it down. Take a picture of it. Take it home with you. Pray this simple prayer. It's based upon this verse. And no matter where you are in your journey, this is a prayer of faith based upon Hebrews 11, verse 6, that I think is a great tool as you build a life of faith. The prayer goes like this: Lord, I believe you're there, and I believe you care. That's it. It's our whole story today. That's the verse we just read. I believe you're there. I believe you care. And no matter where you are, can we embrace that truth today? And maybe you're saying, Arlen, I'm not so sure. I'm considering faith, and I hear, and I'm compelled. I feel God stirring in my heart, but I have some hang-ups because I see certain people who represent God, and they're very dogmatic and not kind, and I just don't see it the way they see it. So I'm struggling to make that leap. But can you come and say, God, at a base level, I don't know about all of that, but I believe you're there and I believe you care. That is faith, that God gives us handles of faith. You can start there. Maybe you are new to faith and you're like, I'm new to my faith journey. I don't feel I know as much Bible as, I don't know, Pastor Arlen or somebody else, you know. But where do I go? Simple prayer. God, I don't know all the answers, but I believe you're there and I believe you care. If you believe that, it will build from there. That'll lead you to the next steps. That'll lead you to following him and whatever he has for you next, baptism, continued growth, all the things that you want to do to aim your life, how you live as a person, as a human, as a spouse, as a parent, as a child, as a worker. Everything that comes out of our life flows from a following Jesus that starts with a belief or a faith in him. And a good foundational prayer is, Lord, I believe you're there. I believe you care. Maybe you've been religious a long time and you've gotten lost in all the religious bickering. How we defend God, how we decry against those who don't express him the way we do within the Christian community and churches or pastors or movements that are don't exactly follow our creeds, and all the pettiness that happens amongst Christianity that turns so many people away. But maybe in the middle of all that noise, you feel God call you back to a simple centering faith again that says, God, I need to remember at the core of it all, I just believe you're there and I believe you care. Maybe you've been burned by faith and you're just tired, you're jaded, you're just walking away because you've seen it. You have a drawer full of t-shirts, you're just ready to be done, you're losing your way, and you're like, I just need something. I got church hurt. I need something to tether my faith to because I'm losing so much. Tether it to one simple idea: God, I don't know all, I don't have all the answers, I don't know what else to hold on to, but I do believe you're there, and I do believe you care. And maybe, just maybe, there's somebody here today and you're going through some real hurt. You've lost a job, you lost some financial stability, you lost your health, you lost a loved one, or someone walked out on you, or something happened, and you are devastated. In a different spot in your life, you could speak eloquently about your faith, you could say all the right things, but right now, you're just trying to keep your head above water and breathe. And prayer seems hard, and you say, I don't know what to say to God. But maybe I can just grab a hold of a simple faith anchor and says, God, I don't understand all that's happening, and I don't know how it's going to all turn out, but I believe you're there, and I believe you care. There's a foundation. There's a foundation that, according to the writer of Hebrews, is faith. And we can work from there. God can work from there. And according to the scriptures, that faith is what pleases God. In the Romans, the Roman officer, his faith was so strong it impressed him. But that faith at its core is what pleases him. And I don't know about you today, but I hope that no matter where we are on that journey, we can say, Lord, I don't have all the answers, but I believe that. And that's what God asks of you and me.